Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, September 7th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Bob Keller. Today he will be continuing his series on the Columbia River. Today's session number is 4 and is titled Columbia River, A Grand Tour with Bill Dietrich. Let's listen in.
My name is Bob Keller. This is the last of a series of 5 meetings we've had this week about the Columbia River. The first session we started off just with some general information about the Columbia and about rivers, about how to think about rivers, different ways to think about rivers. In the second session we had a fairly spirited discussion about the competing uses of the Columbia and whether or not they're compatible and how people can or can't resolve conflicts over how to use the river. In the third session we talked about the Native American history of the river. Yesterday we talked about the fate or the future of the salmon in the Columbia. And that brings us down to today. What I'd like to do today is review a class I taught several years ago on the Columbia River. And I'll go through some of the things that happened in that class. And as I'm talking, if you have some questions or you want to interrupt or ask something, just go ahead. I taught at Western Washington University in Bellingham. And I had the good fortune to teach in a part of Western called Fairhaven College. And the advantage of that was that I could teach courses that sort of broke out of the normal routine of college courses. I could teach courses that, although I'm a historian, I could teach courses that crossed into other areas. And combine things in interesting ways. One way I did that was to teach classes about, I taught one course several times on the history of the Nez Perce Indians, which we ended up traveling Chief Joseph route all the way from Oregon over into Montana. And I taught a course on the Olympic Peninsula, about the Olympic Peninsula, and also a course on the Columbia River. That's one I want to talk about this morning. That course I co-taught with a man named Bill Dietrich. Bill is one of my former students. He went to Fairhaven and Western in about 1970, 71. And some of you probably know now, if you live in Seattle, that he's the science editor of the Seattle Times. About 5 or 6 years ago, Bill started writing a book on the Columbia River, and I asked him if he would be interested in teaching a class about it, or teaching a class with me, co-teaching the class. He agreed to do that, and this is the class that we taught. We taught it in the summer. It was the summer of 93. And the class involved first coming to the campus for a week and spending the week in the classroom. There were about a dozen students. There was Bill and me and about a dozen students. And the students were asked before they came to have read all the books. The books are on the board. If you can read it or not, so I know it's kind of hard to read if the glare's on it. We read a book by a man named James Rhonda called Astoria and Empire, which is a history of the fur trade in the Northwest. Before that, we read, there goes the bus, Sandy. We read an excellent book called Cataclysms on the Columbia, which is a geologic history of the Columbia River. Then we read Nishiwana, The Big River, which is a ethno-history of the Columbia, the story of the native uses of the river, past and present. wrote a book called Columbia River Salmon and Steelhead Trout, about the fish. Then we read a novel, an excellent novel, which I recommend to you, called River Song by a Portland writer named Craig Leslie. And finally, the students read this reader or book of actual documents that I put together from different sources, parts of Lewis and Clark's journals, parts of accounts of the early fur trade, native legends and stories, and so on. And they were supposed to redo all that reading before they came to the first class, which they did, much to my surprise. I was very pleased. They came, they read it. And so we met every day for a week, for 5 days, from 8 in the morning till about 5 in the afternoon, talking about these readings. We had some guests come in. We looked at a number of films, including the films I've shown this week, and tried to learn as much as we could in an academic classroom kind of way about the Columbia River. When that was over, we then took off on a trip, a field trip, which we went from Bellingham to the headwaters of the Columbia. We did this in vans. Bellingham over here to straight as we could to the Columbia River, intersected it at Kettle Falls, and went up to the headwaters of the Columbia, which is a place called Canal Flats in British Columbia. And from there, we followed, as best we could, we followed the river all the way, its entire course, down the river to the mouth, to the Astoria and the bar of the Columbia. And the green marks, if you can see them on this map, is where we camped. We camped, we had tents and sleeping bags, and we camped out for that entire trip. It took us about 7 or 8, 9 days, I've forgotten how much. Seemed like a long time traveling. It ended up being about 3,000 miles with a dozen students and camping all the way, but it was very interesting. And what I'd like to do this morning, fairly quickly, is to just share with you some of the things that happened on that trip, some of the things we learned and that the students ran into. Basically, what I was trying to do in the class, and especially with the field trip, is to get across to them how complicated the management of the river is, or how complicated it is in our time to deal with all the politics and economics and social issues that come up around the Columbia River. And although many of them had biases and prejudices when they started, what I was trying to do is to have them meet people or see things which challenge what they wanted to think or what they would like to think. So as we went down the river, we not only saw lots of things and tried to get some sense of the river itself, but we met a lot of people with different interests in the river, and we talked to them directly. So I'd like to run over some of that, and as I said, if you have some comments or questions as we go to different parts, just speak up. One of the things we did is we traveled along. The students, of course, brought musical instruments, and they played and sang a lot around the campfires at night. We also brought along a tape of old Woody Guthrie songs. Woody Guthrie was a songwriter, came out when they built Grand Coulee in the 1930s, and he promoted the Grand Coulee Dam and public power in the Northwest by writing songs and singing them. You can now get those songs on record or on cassette. We took a cassette along as we drove along in camp. We played Woody Guthrie. What is interesting for someone my age, who sort of grew up with Woody Guthrie and thought it was very great music, what's interesting is how dated it seems to modern students, both the music but also the sentiment in it. They you can't quite get with all the enthusiasm for building dams. That's just sort of how things have changed. One of the things we wanted to do in the trip was to see the parts of the Columbia that were still free running, that were not a reservoir. And everybody says these days there's a large debate going on right now over what's going to happen to the free running part of the river called the Hanford Reach. And everybody said, well, Hanford Reach is the only free running part of the Columbia left. That's quite untrue. Just have to stop and think about it a minute. Everything from Bonneville Dam to the ocean, well over 100 miles, is not dammed, it's free running. There are also several other stretches of the river that look like they probably did hundreds of years ago. One of them is right up here, just below Trail BC, or on the border, where Lake Roosevelt sort of peters out. The river becomes a stream again, and then until you get to this dam up in BC, the Arrow Lakes Dam, there's a stretch in there about, I think about 20 miles. And it has some very big whirlpools and fast water in it.
So you can see that. What did you call that? The name of it? The area?
Well, I just call it the border area.
The border area, okay. Thank
it's
you.
Near, it's just north of Northport, Washington. You have to drive to Northport, and then instead of taking the main road, it goes over the border to Trail. There's a secondary road that goes up along the river to the border, to a border crossing.
Okay.
Just north of Northport. And you can get close enough, that road does in places go close enough river so you can actually see the whirlpools. There is an account of that. There's a book that was published last year called Voyage of a Summer's Sun, which is an account of a man who traveled the length of the Columbia in a canoe for a summer. Not the whole length, I think he put in at about the border, I recall. But he talks about coming down through this area and the fast water describes what it's like. There's a place in there, it's called Dead Man's Eddy. So, give you some idea. It's pretty difficult going. So that's a free-flowing stretch. And then, of course, everything from the headwaters of Columbia Lake or Canal Flats to north of Golden, B.C. The lake starts just past Golden. All this in here is a free-flowing river. And you finally hit the backwaters of the Mica Dam.
So yeah. You were telling me earlier that distance between the Kootenai River and the headwaters of the Columbia is only a couple thousand feet in Canal Flats. Mm-hmm. You happen to know the difference in elevation of the river at versus the lake headwaters?
The difference of the two rivers?
Yeah, elevation.
It's just a few feet. I don't remember. It's something like maybe 20 feet. They call it Canal Flats because they at one time attempted to build a canal between the two rivers to connect them for transportation. And that didn't work for some reason. It fell into disrepair. You still see the traces of the canal, but it's a very slight drop. I mean, looking at it and eyeballing it, you'd say it's level.
So it's just geologic chance that they have the configuration going north and south.
Yeah. And the Kootenai River is fairly big there. I mean, it's quite large. The Columbia is about this wide. And it just looks like a flat.
Yeah.
But it's just enough elevation so the Columbia, the little trickle from what's going to become the Columbia, heads off to the north and the Kootenai's going south.
Now, the reason for the question is there come to see the two dams up there are regulatory dams. Mm-hmm. They're just storage. There isn't any power on them, is there?
No, there's power on them, yeah.
On both of them?
On the
Rostov and Mica?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, anyway, the Kootenai at that point could be diverted into those storage pools if you want.
There's been lots of talk about that and proposed at different times. And today with our machinery and everything, it'd probably be fairly easy to do. But it'd be very difficult to do politically because of all the people downriver in the United States. The Canadians would probably prefer to move it around, put it in the Columbia, because then they'd get all the power off the Kootenai. But the people downriver in the Kootenai wouldn't like that. Okay, so we drove over, we camped at Kettle Falls our first night. We slept right alongside the river. And then we started north. And we had an appointment that morning at a mine just west of Trail. I can't remember the name of the mine, but it's a mine where they will take you inside the mine on a tour. There are miners there, a former miner. The mine's now closed down, but they developed as a tourist attraction. You go there and pay, the miner will take you on a tour, and you go all through the mine. We had an appointment to do that, but the first sort of interesting event on the trip happened at the border. We stopped at the Canadian border crossing to keep going to Canada. And for the first time in my life, I live in Bellingham and across the border all the time. For the first time in my life, they called me over and said they were going to search the van. And I don't know if you ever had that happen or not, but when the border people search the van, they pull everything out and spread it all over the ground. And this was a van full of camping gear. I had about 8 or 9 people in that van with all of our gear, all of our food and everything. They decided they're going to go through it. I thought, okay, I wonder, I couldn't figure out why they were doing that. I still don't know. Because the other van also had students in it, that Bill was driving. They let that go right through. And I couldn't figure out why Bill Dietrich could go through with his students and not me. The only thing I could figure out was that I was wearing this hat, and at that time I had a big, large beard, and I think I may have had sunglasses on that morning. So I had a beard, this hat, and sunglasses, and of course I had camping clothes on. It was a state van, so I thought, it's a state van, belongs to Western Washington University, doesn't matter what I look like, I'm a college professor. Yeah. Dr. Keller didn't make any difference. So they emptied the thing up. By the way, I was just going to be in the light. And then at some point, as I was watching them do all this, it suddenly hit me in the head. I said, what if they brought along some pot? What if the students have stashed? And we said, no liquor on this trip, no drugs or anything. But students being students, I thought, what if they've hidden away some marijuana someplace? I'm really in trouble. Luckily, they hadn't. They didn't find anything. They went through it all. They spread our food all over the place. Said, okay, go ahead. So that was our first crisis on our trip. We went toward the mine, and we didn't go through the Trail smelter. I would have liked to have done that, but if we'd done everything on this trip we'd wanted to do, it would have taken us about 2 months. The Trail smelter tour is about 3 or 4 hours. There's a nice park right across from the smelter and Trail, and we sat there and had our picnic lunch and watched the effluent from the smelter pour out of the smelter right into the river. And that smelter is one of the major polluters of the Columbia River. With the dam now and the lake form, most of that stuff probably settles out in Roosevelt Lake. But it's quite a sight to sit there and see this huge flume of sort of black-gray stuff coming out of the smelter into the river. There's a lot of dispute and litigation in Canada over whether or not the smelter should be cleaned up and how soon and how much. We then moved on to Golden, where we camped the next night. We camped right next to the Kicking Horse River. And that was very exciting because the Kicking Horse is the river that a lot of the early explorers came across when they came across the Rockies down into the Columbia drainage. That's the way they came down. It's the way the fur traders, the voyageurs came down, the Kicking Horse. That's the way David Thompson came, and he discovered the headwaters of the Columbia and became the first man to travel the length of the Columbia. So we slept right there. Then we went on that northern loop toward the Mica Dam, and we went back up into the mountains, into the Selkirk Mountains, into a beautiful mountain stream. And canal flats and Columbia Lake are not very exciting for the headwaters of a big river like the Columbia. But so I took the students up into a mountain stream where it was just, well, sort of like Railroad Creek, only falling a lot and crashing and rushing down. And we sort of said, this is the way the Columbia River should really start, is high in a mountain someplace.
What's the elevation of the headwaters lake?
It's 2,650 feet. The Columbia really doesn't fall all that much. The streamer up the mountain, we were probably up at about 4,000 feet or more. But it's what makes the Columbia River produce so much power is not the amount it drops, but the distance over which it drops, which is over 1,200 miles. Then as we came back down here, coming back down this way, you can't follow the Columbia all the way here along the Arrow Lakes. There's not a road. You go back into the mountains and went up to another old British Columbia mining town that's being restored. And I can't remember the name of it. I should be able to say it, I think of it. It's way back up in the mountains. We drove back up there on a windy dirt road, saw this old mining camp, and it's a lot like Holden. Not as nice as
Barkerville, is it? No, that's up in
the Barkerville's way, that's north.
It's up in the Caribou.
I think it starts with a B, actually. Anyway, we went in there, and we were wandering around looking at all the miners' quarters and everything. And suddenly we saw this big sign explaining something, which was that that mine had been used as a Japanese relocation camp during World War II. The Canadians did the same thing with Japanese citizens that the United States did. They collected them and put them in what we call relocation camps. Well, I just happened to have in my class a Japanese-American student. And she hadn't known about that, and she read this sign and read some of the literature it was around about her ancestors who had been there for 4 years, I think, during World War II. This is a place very much like Holden. It's right up in a mountain canyon. And she got very emotional. It was a very moving moment for her to realize that part of her background and history. Then we crossed the border again, camped just north of Kettle Falls on Roosevelt Lake. Got up the next morning, went down, crossed the lake at Inchulium, and went up to the town called Nespelem on the Colville Reservation. We crossed over to Inchulium and landed on the ferry. I had planned to have the students meet a man named Martin Louis. Martin Louis is a Colville, or I think Nez Perce Indian, who was in his 90s at that time. And I had tried to make arrangements with students to meet him and just talk to him about his tribal history, his background, and having lived there all his life, including long before the Grand Coulee Dam was built. Unfortunately, just I think the day or two before we got there, he had had a stroke or something, and he had been put in a rest home over in Omak. And so we missed doing that. It was very disappointing. We went on into Nespila, went to the tribal headquarters, and talked to a number of people, or had a number of people talk to us about the being Kalva Indians, what it means to live there. One of the things they said, which moved the students a lot, they described how a few years before, when they put the last powerhouse in Grand Coulee, in order to put the powerhouse in, they drew the lake way down, a couple hundred feet. And they drew it down enough so that it exposed Kettle Falls for the first time since 1940, 41. So the Columbia River at that time, for about 30 days, they had the lake drawn down for about 30 days, and I guess the Indians would come from all over and go over there and stand and look at Kettle Falls, and the Columbia was actually running over the Kettle Falls like it once did. Kettle Falls was one of the great fishing sites on the Columbia for the native people in northern Washington. And so they described that to us and what it felt to them like, what it felt like to see that once more. Another thing that happened there, two other things happened with the class. In the early 80s, the Colville tribe signed a contract with a large mining company to mine molybdenum from a place called Mount Tolman. Mount Tolman is the highest peak on the Colville Reservation. You can see it from a long ways off, and it has a rich load of molybdenum. This company had signed this contract to mine it, and the Colvilles at that, this is in the 80s, and the Colvilles had a very good Seattle attorney and drove a very hard bargain and got a very good contract. It would have made them fairly wealthy, something like at the peak, probably $40,000 a year per capita, royalties off the mine. They were going to get royalties and not just rights to go in there. They'd signed this and the exploratory mining work had started. But there was a large controversy within the tribe because to mine the molybdenum, they were going to have to level the mountain. They're going to take off about the top 2,000 feet of the mountain. And some Colvilles were saying, rightly or wrongly, but some were saying, you can't do that. It's going to destroy the wildlife. It's going to destroy the streams. And it's a sacred mountain. It's our high point, and you'll be destroying our sacred mountain. So that controversy had gone on in the early 80s before it finally got resolved. I think the tribe was going to go ahead. The bottom fell out of the molybdenum market, and the company pulled out and abandoned the mine and dropped the whole thing. Well, that's a long, complicated story. But as we were driving up there and looking over at Mount Tolman, I was telling the students this story and setting up this sort of dilemma. How do you balance off the economic welfare of the tribe, and which is very poor and impoverished, and a chance to raise their standard of living considerably? How do you balance that off with these claims of protecting the mountain, protecting the environment? It's a sacred site for people go for vision quests and all that. What would you, I said, well, I set this up and I said, what would you do? And they started arguing in the van, and they started arguing angrily. And pretty soon, I was driving, I was looking in the rearview mirror, pretty soon, way in the back of the van, people were crying. There was the Japanese woman had started crying because she thought they should develop the mine. And we had an Indian woman in the class, a very capable, articulate Indian woman, about 40 years old, and she said, you can't do that to the Mother Earth. So I had this on my hand. I had these two women really angry with each other and upset. which is not something you want to do with a field trip, 10 days of having to live together. Then another issue came, that sort of settled down. We ate lunch, we talked to the people in the tribal center, and then as we're eating lunch, some of the students said, I said, Chief Joseph's grave is just up the road here, and you might want to go just take a look at that. And the Indian woman said, the rest of you can go if you want, but I don't care to do that. I don't think it's right to go look at somebody's grave, to make Chief Joseph's grave into a tourist attraction for people just to come and gawk at. And she said, I don't want to do that. So then the students had another big discussion. Should we go look at the grave or not? And, was it irreverent to do that? Luckily, the Indian woman was, I think, very understanding. She said, I can't do it, but you're not me. You don't have my background. It doesn't bother me if you want to do it. So we had that discussion about graves and grave sites, respecting the dead. Following that, we drove down to and camped at Brewster State Park. Has anybody here ever camped at Brewster State Park? Bridgeport State Park. Bridgeport, it's one of the nicest parks in the state, I think. But the thing that really struck us was the contrast. We had spent the whole day in Nez Pelham on the Colville Reservation. I don't know if you've ever been there or not, but it is a very poor place, and very run down. And you're very aware that you're in the midst of poverty. And then we went to this park, which has great lawns. It has a golf course attached to it. And there were big motorhomes sitting around. And also, we set up our camp. And then we went down into Bridgeport to buy some groceries. Well, Bridgeport, at least the part we got into, was almost totally Hispanic and also very poor. We bought our groceries there and felt sort of uncomfortable and uneasy being Caucasians. But back up to this very nice campground. So we had these contrasts of poverty on the reservation, migrant workers in Bridgeport, and then us sitting here in a very comfortable, pleasant place, right by Chief Joseph Dam. The next morning we got up and drove down to an apple orchard just right across from Chelan. When you go back to Chelan and look down on the Columbia River, you look across the river, and you'll see one of the largest orchards over there is owned by a man named Grady Auville, who is in his mid-80s now. He's probably about 90. And we met him in his living room and sat and talked to him for about 2 hours. And the advantage of talking to him is that he believed and stood for just about everything that most of the students didn't. When we walked in, the radio was going, and the radio program that was on was Rush Limbaugh. Grady Auville is a self-made person in the old sense of the word. He bought some land there in about 1938 or 39, started planting trees, apple trees, and managed over 50 years to make it into a very successful orchard, and did it by himself and his family. So the students were pretty prejudiced against agriculture, against irrigation, against the dams, those kind of things. But to talk to someone for whom the dam had literally transformed their lives, and later we talked to some wheat farmers who had the same experience. The dam really meant going living from poverty to being able to make it. But to talk to this person directly and personally, he was very clear and articulate, had a very good memory, and was very friendly with them. But it was quite challenging to them to meet an Eastern Washington apple orchard person who thought very differently than most of them did. They took them out and gave them all a bunch of apples, which made them happy. Then we went to the Wenatchee World. We spent a couple afternoon going to the Wenatchee World, talking to the editors. We went to, lost track of the order thing, but somewhere in there we went to Grand Coulee Dam. And the thing that I think really struck the students at Grand Coulee was, after having done all this reading and talked, by this time we talked to a lot of people with different points of view, and we studied the problems, and you go to Grand Coulee, and what is presented to the public, what the government there presents to the public, is sort of a completely sugar-coated view of what the dam means. You could go there and not get a glimmer of an idea that there are any problems in the area, or the dam had created any problems. It just is all sort of promotion. And that contrast between what was being said in government propaganda on the one hand, and what the students have been seeing and doing on the other, that sort of contrast or clash made them think, which is what I was trying to do. The next day, we spent another very interesting day, the whole day, from 8 in the morning till about 4 in the afternoon on the Hanford Reservation, at the Hanford Project. We got there, we got an introductory lecture. Again, it's pretty sugar-coated. Explaining the history of the project, the background, how it came to be. And then we got on a bus with a tour director whose name I've forgotten. You might even know him. He's a chemist at Hanford. And he took us for about 4 hours to the old reactors, the sites, and we got to go through one of the shutdown reactors, which was a fantastic experience. We'd never done that. And they explained all how it all worked. At that time, one of the reactors was still working. We didn't get to go on that one, but we saw it. We were all around the reservation. And they showed us all the things they were doing to clean it up, or what they were trying to do to clean it up, and how they hoped it would work. And the enormous amount of money that's being spent there. So that was, and that was all from the point of view of the government and the Westinghouse Corporation and the people of the Tri-Cities. We, again, didn't hear too much or hardly anything about the difficult problems at Hanford. After that, we drove down past, across the river. What's the name of the community? As you go toward Pendleton, after you cross the river, there's a place where they have buried, there's miles and miles where they have buried biological warfare chemicals. The federal government's done that. And they just look like mounds or something, unless you knew it was there. But if you know it's there, you know, this is that, well, as far as you can see in some direction, is the ground has been filled up with these leftover chemical and biological warfare. We came back and camped after the Great Bend. The chemical burial site's right in here. And then we came up and camped at a state park called Crow Butte. That night I had arranged for a class to meet with a man named Al Satie, who is a Yakima Indian who had been a militant Yakima Indian and at one point had been involved in what was called a salmon scam, the arrest of Indians for illegal fishing and selling of salmon on the Columbia River. He had been arrested for being involved in that and had spent 3 years of his life in Leavenworth, federal prison. eventually he was released, come back, and he's now still very much advocating the rights, treaty rights, his view of the interests of his tribe. So he met with us that evening. It was a clear August evening. We had a campfire and we're sitting around it and talking. And Al looks very much like a typical Indian. I mean, he's probably not 100%. He's pretty much full blood. So we're sitting around and he's talking, telling stories and legends about his tribe, explaining his point of view, talking about what it was like in prison, around the campfire about midnight under the stars. And the contrast with that, of that with the tour we had earlier that day on Hanford, and then the tour through the Wenatchee World, and the Grand Canyon was very striking. The next day we drove down the river on the Washington side, which is a must. If you want to tour the river, it's much better to stay on the Washington side instead of going on the Oregon side, because the Oregon side you've got Interstate, 80, which makes it hard to see anything. And looks like every other interstate in the world. Mm-hmm. But you stay on the Washington side, it's a two-lane road. It goes up and down, in and out like that. You can pull off in places and look down on the river, and it's a much better way to tour it. By noon, we came into White Salmon. White Salmon's in the Columbia River Gorge, and that map there is a map of the gorge. The gorge is where the river goes through the Cascade Mountains. And I don't have time to go into all of this, except to say that there's a, right now, for the last 10 years, there's an enormous controversy going on about what's to become of the gorge. And whether or not, how the gorge, the population of the gorge is growing very fast. Portland, the city of Portland is moving east up the gorge. It's being subdivided. Little towns like Stevenson are doubling in size every so many years. And it's growing fast. And many people think that the gorge will be, its natural beauty will be destroyed. So there's the big debate over what's to be done with it. The government has come in, it's been declared a national scenic area, and the government is trying to manage all these competing interests. All the different colors on that map are different land uses or zoning or things that they're trying to work out. Give you some idea of how big and complicated it is. This is the management plan for the Columbia River Gorge. This is how they're going to try to run it. Very emotional, very controversial, and complicated. We set up a meeting in the office of the federal office in White Salmon of the people who are trying to manage this program. And we had four people to talk to us. One was the federal bureaucrat, the federal administrator is a better word, of this whole program, the person in charge of doing this. Another was a man, a private landowner in near White Salmon, owned a bunch of acreage. He wanted to subdivide it way up on the bluff and wanted to turn it into housing lots, and had been told he couldn't do that, stopped from doing it. Another was a man who had wanted to turn the whole gorge into a national park, and lost that battle. And finally, there was a woman from Portland who was the head of, I can't remember the name of the groups, but Friends of the Gorge or some group like that, that was trying to protect the gorge, an environmentalist. These are the four people that talked to us. And but it didn't work out that way. They ripped into each other. I couldn't believe my eyes. We sat down around this big conference table, a room about this size, And I thought, okay, students can ask some questions or children can make a statement. And right from the start, they started attacking each other. They all knew each other and they all hated each other. And they just, it was embarrassing. And it was all personal. And the students didn't understand all this, know all this personal background. They were attacking each other's personal lives and their personalities and their families. And you did this and you did that. Well, this is the best way to illustrate of how emotional it was. And it went on for 2 hours. We sat in there for 2 hours listening to these people just go at each other. I mean, it was great from a teaching point of view, because we can always read this stuff, but it really got across of how intense and difficult things were. One of the students in my class was a guy named Paul Jacobson. Paul was the center on Western's basketball team. Paul was 6'7" or 8 inches tall and weighs about 250 pounds. You should probably have to duck on that. He's a great big hulking German Swede or something. Paul was sitting there for about half an hour or the first 45 minutes listening to these people, and he finally just got up and walked out. I asked him what was the matter. He said, "I can't take it. I can't sit here and listen to people rip into each other like that and treat each other that way. I was getting such a headache. I was getting sick and I had to leave the room." That's how intense it was. We went on from there. Now we're headed out. We camped that night at Beacon Rock. Some of the students thought they had a great sign at Beacon Rock. They got up early the next morning, walked to the top of the rock, and just as they got on top of Beacon Rock, an eagle was going around. And some of them thought that was a real sign for our class. Then we went down to Astoria, in the mouth of the river. Astoria's got a superb maritime museum. If you haven't been there, you should go there sometime. I had planned to spend the last 2 days of the trip at Fort Stevens, which is right at the mouth of the river by the jetty on the Oregon side. And I'd gone down there in March or April with my wife to camp and visit some friends, and I thought, well, I'll make the reservations for the campsite. When you're traveling around with 15 people in the summer, you want to have reservations for campsites. So I went up there and said, I'd like reservations for our college class, 15 people, 10th of August or whatever. And they looked at their things and they said, sorry, we're full. We're full. I said, what? How can you be full in March? I'm talking about August. Well, it turns out that was the weekend of the sailboat regatta at Astoria, in the mouth of the Columbia. And I guess everybody comes from all over the Northwest with sailboats. And everything fills up. So here I was, wanting to finish my trip up there, and but no place to camp. Well, luckily I went over to the KOA campground and managed to get two or three tent sites that were still left. This is in March. I got those, said, okay, I've got it made. I got tent sites at the KOA. So here we come, we're coming in there. The students don't know this. They think we're going to another state park or about to camp out. And we pull into the KOA and it's a zoo. It is, I think, like thousands of people and their campers and RVs and everything else and kids. And it's just crawling with people. And there I have my KOA rebellion. The students were going to say, we're not going to camp here. We will not camp here. I said, I'm the teacher. We're going to camp here. You know? And by this time, I paid. Everything's paid and all that. And we take the and we go out to look at the tent sites. Well, tents don't, probably realize, don't count for much in KOAs. Some of them will make some space for them. We had three sites that were maybe about 10 feet by 10 feet
each
with a picnic table, and no trees, no vegetation, none of that. just dusty, dirty cars went by, cars racing around. We're not going to stay here. I said, okay, where are we going to stay if we're not going to stay here? We've already been paid, and it cost something like, for two nights, I think it was $120-some for 10 sites. So we have this big discussion. The first real big crisis of the trip. Okay, let's go. We'll go back into Astoria or back into Portland. We'll get a motel, right? Commute. Finally, they confiscated. In the KOA, they have sort of common areas with a kind of a kitchen area that's covered with sinks and things that people can use. We moved over to that, and this common area was very nice. It was covered. It was starting to rain, by the way. But it also had green grass all around it and trees. So the student said, we paid that much money, we're going to camp. First day in here, we're camping here. All the tents went up, waiting for the KOA people to come around and evict us. But we talked to them and worked that out. The exciting thing that happened besides that, still having student rebellions in the 1990s. The exciting thing that happened at Astoria, and very unusual for the students, was we got to go out in a bar pilot boat, which is most people don't ever get on. I don't know if you know what the bar pilots are. They're the boats that go out over the Columbia River Bar to meet the incoming freighters. And the bar pilot gets off this boat onto the freighter, and then actually comes the captain or the skipper or the pilot of the freighter as it crosses the bar into the mouth of the Columbia. And then another pilot, a river pilot, comes on at that point and takes the freighter or the ship or whatever on up the Columbia. But the bar pilot goes out there and actually brings it across the bar, which is the one of the three most dangerous bars in the world. It's a bar where something over 2,000 ships have gone down around the Columbia River Bar. 1,500 or more people have died trying to cross the bar. And although it's fairly tame today compared to what it was in 1840 or 1850 or even 1900, because of the jetties, it is still considered the third most dangerous bar anywhere. Mm-hmm. These guys go out there in all kinds of weather. They normally shut the bar down maybe for a day or two, once or twice a year. I think it costs something like $100,000 an hour or something for the bar to be, for ships not to be able to cross the Columbia River Bar. So there's, because if the ships can't go across the bar, they go, instead of going to Portland, they go to Seattle. It's that expensive. If they sit out there for a day or two, they save money if they go to Seattle to unload instead of going to Portland. So there's great pressure to bring the boats across the bar. And that's what these guys have to do. And they go out there and I think the winds have to get up to around 50 or 60 miles an hour, 45 to 50 miles an hour before they start to consider shutting it down. And it's up to them whether or not to shut it down.
Is that the only reason why they shut it down? Why would they shut it down?
Because they don't want to sink the ships. I mean, they make
for
the judgment
that
it's too dangerous. They can't. The waves get 50 feet high out there.
It's very shallow, so it generates big waves.
It generates big waves. They're standing up like that, and it's shallow. And so if you hit the bar, you get hung up on the bar in a storm, you're finished.
The channel evidently moves, too.
The channel,
they're the ones who are knowledgeable about where it's moved to.
They know where it is, and they can find it. There's, you might want to look after we're through, I penned a story up here about the first woman bar pilot. It's a very elite group of people. There's only about 22 of them that are allowed to do this. It's private. It's not a government organization. It's a private organization. And anyway, to get out to the boats, they ride out on these bar pilot boats. which are virtually indestructible boats and extremely powerful. And so we got to ride on one. We didn't get to go out on the bar, but we got to, they were taking a bar pilot boat from somewhere in Astoria up to some other point. So we got the whole class on that, and we got to do it, got to talk to a bar pilot all the time about their work and how they did it and what they did, how they trained for it. You don't become a bar pilot until you're probably in your 40s, the amount of experience you have to have. This guy had been a skipper for ARCO, or one of the big super tankers, for about 15 years. He'd been in the Navy and then went to work on a super tanker. And with that much experience, they finally decided he might qualify to be a bar pilot. Got the job. So we did that, and then the final thing we did is went down to the jetty, and the whole class went wading in the Pacific Ocean at the mouth of the Columbia River. So we can say we waded in the Columbia River when it was a creek that you could just walk across, and then we waded in the ocean where it entered the ocean. Packed up and went home. Yeah.
Have they dredged the channels through that bar?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a losing, it's a constant process. If you go to the Maritime Museum, one of the interesting things to do is ask them to bring out, they've published charts of the mouth of the Columbia from about 1850 on, from the first diagrams made of Lewis and Clark, which wouldn't have soundings in it, but the first charts for navigating the mouth of the Columbia from 1850 to the present. They just got these in about 5-year intervals, and if you can spread them out on the floor like that and just start looking across them, and it's sort of like a moving picture. The channel is just going like that. It's just way over here, it's just way back here, over there, and it can do it very fast. It takes out whole pieces of land. Well, Oregon and Washington have had lawsuits and fights and everything about where the border is between the two states, which was crucial. At one time, we regulated the fishing by saying that Oregon regulated its side of the river and Washington regulated the fish on its side of the river. And so it was very crucial where the center of the river was for the fishermen. We don't do that anymore. That didn't work. But that is just shifted all over. If you look at those charts, just get them all laid out, you get a real sense of how powerful nature is, how powerful that river is, even today with all the dams on it and with the jetties there and with the dredging and everything we're doing to try to manage it. It's just, I think, inescapable. If you look at those maps or charts, the river's got its own mind. And it's not, in the long run, it's not controllable. If we adjust to it, at least at the mouth. Yeah.
Well, I work with the Corps of Engineers. I have for 20 years. A few comments.
Yeah.
Bridgeport State Park is nice because we built it. I did the redesign and we built it. And there's poverty everywhere where Uncle Sam doesn't drag people out of poverty. Mm-hmm. As far as Humatil Army Depot, I manage that. We've completed designs for a weapons incinerator there, which hasn't been built yet. And I'm totally behind a dam on the Hanford Reach. But my question is, you've given a good travel log, but what do you feel yourself? What is your opinion about what has happened to the river?
To the river?
Yes.
What I feel about it, or what I think has happened, or both, I suppose.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't think it's not a river anymore. So it's a lake or a reservoir. And in transforming it, we have gained some enormous benefits from that. And that's why I kept trying to get the students to recognize ones that especially didn't like the dams. That there are, if you want to take the dams out, you got to think what you'd give up or what would be lost, which is under the hydropower, but the irrigation, the wheatlands, and all of that. So. But the thing, I think we've also really lost something powerful and significant in our history, in the history of the region, which was the free-flowing river, the free-running river. I think if we end up losing the salmon, that is going to be a great loss. Oh, I forgot to say one comment. We were talking to Grady Auville about the salmon. The students were very concerned about the salmon and the drawdowns of the river, the flow levels and everything. He just couldn't hear what they were saying. He just couldn't comprehend how anybody would worry about this. And he made just a great statement I'll never forget. He said, "Those environmentalists, I just don't understand how people can be more concerned about fish than food."
Who was that?
Who was this? The archerist?
No, he's an orchardist, yeah.
The orchardist,
Well, my opinion, of course, is what's done is done, but there was a great national will to build these dams,
yeah.
but there is not a great national will to solve the problems. Well, what technology creates, more technology can, to a large part, fix, but things are not being fixed all that much. There were certain irreversible mistakes made, such as Chief Joseph Dam, the High Head Dam, no fish get above Chief Joseph Dam, but in retrospect, probably somebody could have figured out a way to get the fish around that dam, but they didn't because they didn't think it was important. The same thing is true of Grand Coulee, but in that process, the fish that were biologically capable of migrating to Canada died, period, and the genetic pool was totally lost. So you can't bring that back. But there's a lot that people could do if the federal government had the will to solve the problems. And I don't see that happening so much.
And the money.
True. Well, it all boils down to money. With enough money, you can do anything. Yeah. It's not a priority to fix things. People, in government, the public in general, will just accept what's happened.
But for that to happen, people also have to agree on what they have to agree to spend the money, but they also have to agree what the problem is, how to fix it.
But they can't even agree to build a weapons incinerator at Umatilla.
Yeah, and they can't agree upon all other things. became really obvious in talking to all these people up and down the river on that trip is that everybody thought somebody else was the problem. The Archer people thought that the salmon aren't there, it's the fishermen. They're overfishing it at the mouth of the river. The fishermen thought it was the dams. This person thought it was that person. Everybody was saying it's somebody else who's doing it. They're causing the problem. And as long as you keep thinking that way, you're never going to get any place. I guess just to answer your question, I certainly don't think you can take all the dams out. I think that's just... We had that discussion earlier this week about taking the dams out. I think that's just talking through your hat and wasting your time. Even if you wanted to do it, it's just politically impossible. I guess personally, I tend to feel that we, as a society, as a technological society, we often overshoot the mark. We figure out how to do something that's good and beneficial, and we think, well, if one's good, two's better, three's even better, and 20 times as good. And at some point, you begin having the costs Or I think we go too far in developing things. We could show some restraint. For instance, I'd be very happy with just having Salina Falls still there. We'd still be able to see Salina Falls or the Downs. We just hadn't built that particular dam. Instead of virtually damming the entire river, if we could have left some parts of it in its natural state for other purposes, aesthetic or spiritual or historic purposes. As a historian, I would really like to be able to go. Well, actually, I did see Salina Falls, but I was only 4 years old.
What's the name of that falls again?
Salina.
Yes,
C-E-L-I-L-O. It was the biggest. That and the Dalles were the biggest native fisheries on the river.
Mm-hmm. When you started the lecture today, you said you were going to tell us where the free-flowing river still exists, and all I put down was the border area.
But the Messina is also the Hanford Reach. Ben Franklin dam site is the last good dam site on the river.
That's the Hanford Reach.
Well, how many people want to die to keep the Hanford Reach wild? I don't know. Yeah. I'm not going to. I'm all for building a dam there. The rest of the river is all screwed up anyway. So.
Is that the only two places then?
No, I forgot that there's from Bonneville Dam to the mouth is
right. Bonneville to the mouth.
Free flowing. The Hanford Reach is about 50 miles along the Hanford Reservation. Mm-hmm. And then that little stretch of about 15 or 20 miles near the border. And then from the headwaters to the backwater of the Mica Dam, which is probably about 50 miles, I think, 75 miles. It's a stream there.
Is it in Canada?
It's in Canada.
Okay.
You had a fascinating situation with a Fairhaven College versus the philosophy of Rush Limbaugh. You couldn't be more extreme. I wondered if, at the end of this trip, with the students, did you have a feeling that they could reach any kind of consensus on a resolution of these two thought extremes? You saw wonderful examples of all the way along. What did they feel like? What were they thinking at the end of the trip?
Some of them felt very confused.
Must have.
About what they thought. What they thought. Others, I think, all of them would say something like, "It's more complicated than I thought." No matter what I conclude. One of the things that made it hard for them is that the people we met, like Grady Onville and people of the Wenatchee world, and we met a wheat farmer and his wife at the Crescent Bar campground, who had, as I think I said earlier, they were here before the dam was built and raised their family there. They're now in about their 70s. And they were, all the people we met and talked to were very nice people, personally. And that always makes it more difficult if you have political differences or philosophical differences or religious differences with someone, if they happen to be nice people instead of ogres. And that made it difficult for the students. I think that's... most of them at the time had not totally changed their mind about all those things. There was one thing that I think most of them felt, I think this is the common feeling, I'm on overload. They kept saying, I'm on overload. I've had too much to absorb. I can't absorb it all. I can't handle it all. I've got to have some time to process this, to think about it, to study some more. This is right at the end of the trip. One of the things we did, we went back to Bellingham. We spent another day in the classroom and wrote a class journal. We did it's called a group writing process, where we wrote this story of our trip as a class. And I forgot that I didn't bring that with me. I wish I had you. There's some really interesting entries in that. So we processed it the next day, but even after that, they were still, it was just too much, too fast. My head was swimming, and I'd study this stuff for quite a while, but after the day on the Hanford Reservation, I just didn't know where I was coming or going. There's so much information, and it was such big things. So much had happened there. Just the history of Hanford and what it meant in the history of the world is enough to make you dizzy. But, yeah.
You talked about the Indian sacred site, and I'm wondering how this fits, if you've got any consideration of how all of this fits into our concept of sacredness.
Well, that's a big question. You need to stay around. Next week, I'm teaching a class here on the history of missions to the American Indians. And in the last session of that, we're going to talk about something called the Native American Religious Freedom Act, which deals with that question.
Well, with the question of our own religion?
No, of the difference between a Christian view of, quote, sacred places and a Native American view. And the problems that creates when you try to deal with it in the law. Right? When the tribe of the Indians start making legal claims about sacred sites, how do you handle that in a society like ours, which doesn't think that way about religion? That's what we're going to be discussing that just a week from today, probably. But basically, it's different. It's very complicated. One of the things that complicates it is that it can be quite easy to claim anything as a sacred site. Mm-hmm. And so how do you establish it? And it also, what may be a sacred site to one Native person may not be to another. Mm-hmm. And if you want to stop something, it can be a convenient legal ploy to use to say, the Indians consider this their sacred site, therefore you can't put this telescope here. That's going on, been going on in a place called Mount Graham in Arizona for about the last 10 years. That's a convenient, just because it's convenient doesn't mean it's not true, but it also can be a very convenient way to block something. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex question. Yeah, go ahead.
One very simple outlook on building the Hanford plant. My neighbor would put him on his feet. They came over there. He, at the start of the war, had a brand new international pickup, and the company came and rented it from him at a good price, and he walked to town because he walked right by our place. So it was just in order to get equipment for it, they went to that extent. And as I say, it put our neighbor on his feet. But
you know, it's left a legacy now. I mean, building a dam there is not just deciding to do it. I mean, the technical problems are so huge now that nobody just wants to deal with it. Or too many people want to deal with it.
Well, it is a good boost for the economy. And trying to deal with it is a good boost for the economy of Tri-Cities. That was one of the things in that tour. Another of the things that really I couldn't sort out is that on the one hand, the tour people, director, and people were telling us how safe all this was, that there really was no problem, it was all safe, nuclear energy is completely safe, nothing, and they did all this right. And then they were telling us, we're spending $75 million here this year or something to fix it somehow.
Mostly in layers.
So, on one hand, we're spending billions of dollars to fix something which we're told is safe.
I think we ought to realize how the complexity has multiplied in this. When we were building the dams on the Columbia in the early days, we didn't see it as a very complex picture. We didn't see all these factors that were really should have been looked at. And because we become more educated about these problems now, it increases the complexity of doing anything. And maybe we should realize that when we're looking at building yet another dam on a river, which is already very complex now in its problems, that we have to look at the many angles. Well, you can't go in and decide because you have the technology to do something that this makes it right.
Nobody today, I think, will build a dam or anything anywhere with the ease and freedom that was done in the 1920s and 30s. That is.
How about the idea now of taking down the Elwha Dam, for instance? Shouldn't we look at that same?
Yeah, but Martha, I mean, that's apples and oranges. You're talking about a failing structure. And none of these are you. These are gravity dams, and they're going to sit there. But Elwha is shot. I mean, there's nobody that wants that thing.
It's also private.
That's the problem.
Well,
it's private.
Maybe you have to look at building a new dam as something that has a finite life. It doesn't just extend into the future and be useful forever after.
Yeah, but the way we build stuff, they will last forever.
Well,
like
didn't you build the
Elwha Dam? No, that was private, and it was badly done. And you got to separate bad dams from good dams.
You're saying that your technology is okay. The other guy's technology is not perfect, but yours is okay. I think that you need to regard more than technology when you look at.
But the other day we were talking about all this, and someone was saying, "Well, to take the dam out," they were talking about the Grand Coulee, taking the Grand Coulee out. I said, well, if you want to try that, here's an example of how hard it's going to be to do that. There's the Elwha Dam sitting over there, which has got this, and this going against it. There are some people that defend it, but almost nobody defends it very much. There's that dam sitting there. If you're ever going to remove any kind of a dam,
practice on that.
You should be able to get that one out, and they've been working
for years.
The tribe first started arguing that should come out in about 1971 or 72.
Yeah.
That's 25 years ago, and it's still sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
There's still studies going on and commissions and all this stuff. And everybody says with the current Congress that the Elwha Dam's not coming out.
Well, what trouble with the Columbia in general was that they started with Rock Island Dam. It was a low-head dam on the best site. So they wasted the best site on the river with kind of a crummy dam. So everything, you got smarter as you went both ways.
And didn't you say there are 70 dams on the drainage system of the Columbia?
51.
Counting this, 51.
51.
But that's a lot of dams.
Mm-hmm.
Includes the Snake River.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about two extremes of taking dams out or not taking them out. What have you learned about the possibility of helping or restoring the salmon runs with fish ladders, for instance? I've heard two things about the Grand Coulee, for instance. I've heard always traditionally it's too high, you can't build a fish ladder over it. Then I've heard other people say that's not true with modern technology.
It's not true with modern technology. You got your answer.
In other words, it could be done.
Sure.
Technically.
At the time when they built it, built a fish ladder, from what I understand, the fish ladder would have been about 6,000 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
To get over the coulee because it was so high.
Now that's
a little over a mile.
You've got to worry about the little ones coming down.
But you know what I was saying? That genetically, those fish are gone. The fish that could survive that trip.
That's true. And they can be reestablished
on a long-term basis.
Well, with enough money, you see. Like I say, it's priorities. Right. No, nobody's thinking
not
about
those
that.
Fish.
Yeah. I just read about some flotation method now they have to help the little ones who are coming down so they won't go into the turbines.
There are all kinds of techniques and possibilities, all of which are controversial, and all of which cause problems for somebody.
Then we need to try it.
Biologically, probably the best thing to do is to draw down the river, or to let the river run, to pick up the current of the river during certain times to get the fish down it. That causes enormous problems for other people.
So it's
all this type of thing. And,
so I don't see adding another dam would decrease your problem. that you already have.
No, no, it doesn't decrease any problems. And the fact is, what's the benefits? The benefits would be enormous.
What's the benefit?
Hydropower, yeah, or irrigation.
What are the benefits from
another? Oh, one more question there.
All I was going to say is, if we had had to consider every implication, we'd still be planning Grand Coulee Dam.
Yeah.
I mean, that was built in a depression at a time when people wanted work. We wanted some land for people to live on in small acreages, and it went ahead and was done. And to say, if we were going to get every implication out of the way before we built it, it's taken, as you said, 25 years, everybody agreeing the dam, Elway Dam should come out, and we can't do that.
They still don't agree. Yeah, we can't do it.
But Paul, Grand Coulee was probably an abuse of the American taxpayer. They threw everything in the world into that, pump storage and the whole thing, just so the Bureau of Reclamation could say, hey, we're the greatest. Look at all the stuff we have here.
Yeah.
We've got everything in the world here. What for?
Yeah, they did.
I furnish a lot of jobs.
Well, I did that.
I think it's just a big
fantasy park.
Well, now versus the 30s.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's very different.
But I don't think Columbia River should have been used for somebody's ego.
What do they do about it? They get family above Grand Coulee, and they go in there someplace and spawn, and they get a whole bunch of fry, and then they come down, and they go through the generator, and they're going to end up chopped meat. What do they do about that?
Well, you'd have to screen them out and get them around somehow, but they wouldn't do very well even if they got above the Grand Coulee, because they would be in a 151-mile-long lake before they, with a lot of the side streams filled up. They'd have a hard time finding a place to spawn. And the fish, what do they call those big Chinooks? There's a name they had for the huge Chinooks that went up above the Grand Coulee. I forgot what it is, but they were the biggest Chinooks. They were about 5 feet long and up to 125 pounds.
Yeah.
They were that big because they were able to get that far up. Grand Coulee, 600 miles up the river.
Are you talking about sturgeon?
Oh, no. I'm talking about fish that don't exist anymore, is what he's talking about.
Yeah. Cool.
They genetically, the gene pool's gone.
Yeah. They had to be able to store that much to get that far, because the fish don't eat in the river, so. And those are gone forever.
Yeah, and that's your biggest problem.
Have you seen the television movie that Gene Walkinshaw made recently about the Columbia?
Just
a month or so ago, a couple months ago, she made a very interesting documentary.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Did you say you were...